Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
The state's Department of Elementary and Secondary Education released guidance today on how schools could reopen this fall, and it includes a lot of things you might expect: having teachers and students wear face masks, spacing desks at least 3 feet apart, and keeping students in the same group throughout the school day. But there are still some unanswered questions. And joining us now to help answer some of those questions is Jeff Riley. He's the commissioner of the Education Department. Commissioner Riley, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start by acknowledging you had a pretty tough balancing act here. You're trying to weigh public health and safety concerns with concerns about students' academic and emotional well-being. So I'm curious, as you were forming this plan, what are some of the most important factors you were thinking about?
You know, for us, the key, I think, was the safety of our students and teachers as we sought to go back. And we kind of researched and really enlisted the best medical people we could find to help us think through what are the best actions we can take to make school safe when we do return.
So speaking of medical experts, I know you got a letter from the Massachusetts chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, really encouraging students to go back to in-classroom learning in the fall. They're especially concerned with children who rely on additional services schools supply, like counseling services or food supplements, things like that. And they're also concerned that remote learning kind of exacerbates the achievement disparities across income levels, racial groups. What did you make of that letter? And did you have a response to some of those concerns?
Yeah, I mean, I think we were grateful for the endorsement from the incoming president of the Pediatric Association in Massachusetts. He believes and their association believes that kids should go back to school. There are costs associated with kids being out of school, and we've seen some of those. We understand there's food insecurity, there's trauma and mental health issues. There's all the racial issues that have come up that school would be a good place for teachers to kind of work on helping students process that information. So there are, you know, there's certainly a lot of reasons to go back to school. And at the same time, we recognize that we want to do so in a way that's, you know, as safe as completely possible.
So there are concerns that just being closed for the few months that schools were closed this past term, that basically, some students could be up to a year behind in terms of where they would be education-wise, a study that was published by the New York Times. Do you have any specific approaches to catching those students up that might have fallen behind during the period of closure?
Yes, we do. I mean, what I would say is, first and foremost, I don't think anyone believes that any type of remote learning can ever replace what happens in in-person instruction. We just don't think it's comparable. With that said, we're not exactly sure what the gaps will be. We do think that there will be learning loss, and we do need to kind of sort that out and assess that in our students. There have been some who have said that we need to go to assessment in the first week of school, and I've said no. I think we need to get our kids back into the routine of learning and focus on their social emotional health in the beginning. But there will be a time, and districts always do this in the first month, where they kind of assess where students are functioning. And at that point, we'll really have a better idea of what the learning loss is and where it is. And then when we talk about how do you remediate that, we've put out a multi-million dollar grant program for districts that are interested both in the summer and over the vacations to work with students who have fallen behind.
So you talk about concerns bringing kids back to the classroom. Mass Inc. polling group recently did a poll kind of looking at different groups of parents and how they are thinking about returning to school in the fall. And there were some pretty staggering numbers in terms of Black and Latino parents of K-12 students. Basically, 69% of white parents either felt very or somewhat confident in sending their kids back to school, but just 48% of Black parents, 44% of Latino parents feel the same way. I'm struck by the fact that those are the same racial groups that have been hit disproportionately by the pandemic. What would you say to some of those parents who are feeling those concerns right now?
Well, I mean, look, I want to be clear. Parents, we respect their decisions and their choices on their children and schooling. And so we understand there are concerns, and we're going to be sympathetic to those and work with parents as schools open on what they choose to do. I do think that we have seen variation across the state in communities that have been hit hard and some others that haven't. And so the question for me is, how do we provide additional supports to those districts that have been hit the hardest and or those districts that have been historically shortchanged to make sure that they get the resources that they need, both technical, financial, computer devices and such, so that we can get out, so we can make it as fair as possible. And at the same time, you know, today I think was the first day we saw the medical community stand up and say, we do think going back to school is the way to go. And so, you know, we're going to let parents make their decisions on what they think is best for their children. What we're going to try to do is make sure that there's a sense of equity and fairness across our communities.
You mentioned financial as one of the concerns. Obviously, anytime you're talking about schools, they're often asked to do a lot on a shoestring budget. We actually spoke with Joseph Sawyer, superintendent of Shrewsbury Public Schools, and he said he's confident in the research that the state has done and consulting with public health experts. But basically, the challenge is figuring out how to afford everything on this pretty condensed timeline. Here's a little bit of what he said.
If you've had a lot of experience with it, if you've seen your family members or your neighbors go through the symptoms.
That's actually Steve Pizzella of Massing Polling Group looking for Joseph Sawyer, Edu 4, if we could get Edu 4 from the control room. Challenges of remote broadcasts. So bear with us.
It's both trying to plan for doing school in a way that we've never done before, at the same time with huge question marks about the amount of funding that we'll have, not knowing the level of staffing we'll have to be able to execute the kind of planning and work that will need to happen to come back to school in the fall is probably the most complex work that school administrators have done in their career.
So I understand, Commissioner, that you wanted to leave things open so that districts would have flexibility to do what they feel is right for their district. But in terms of funding, what can you tell schools who are looking at, hey, the state has a potentially $4 billion shortfall in the budget? We know that Gateway Communities, for example, we're going to get an extra $217 million this year alone. What would you say to schools who are worried that the funding to establish these new protocols just isn't going to be there?
Well, it's certainly something that we have to kind of pressure test. What I would say is what we know is this. The Department of Education applied for and received federal money, almost $200 million that we sent out to districts. Are they eligible to apply for those dollars? And it's based on a Title I formula. So essentially, the poorer communities get more money. Today, in addition to that, the governor announced an additional $200 million for districts to get even more money, because I think there is a recognition that to bring schools back under the new medical kind of conditions or parameters will cost money. Now, the hard part and what we don't know right now is, will there be a fourth stimulus package from the federal government, and what will the funding look like in Massachusetts? And because we don't know, and because we probably won't know until July or August even, and maybe even beyond that, what we've done at the department is we've said, be prepared for all contingencies. Be prepared for remote learning, be prepared for a hybrid model, and be prepared for an in-person model with these medical parameters. But what I think is, and as an advocate for the educational community, we need to kind of really stand tall and say that there are funds that are going to be needed to do this safely and to do it well.
Yeah, I think I know some activists in the state have asked if you're willing to dip into the about $3.5 billion rainy day fund. Is that something the state's thinking about if the federal government doesn't come through, say?
So, I don't want to speak for the administration. I'm the Department of Education, but I think they'll look at everything given the financial situation. And I think a lot of people now are waiting to see what the federal government is going to do with this fourth stimulus package or not. So I think that will be kind of a tipping point. Until then, the best we can do is, we've been able to get additional dollars for the schools, and we can plan for a variety of contingencies so that we can get the best possible outcome.
So I want to come back to something you said about preparing for basically all contingencies. I understand we don't know what things are going to look like in the fall, but from a teacher's perspective, that obviously presents a pretty big challenge. I want to play a little bit of sound here from Joellen Persaud, an inclusion and moderate disabilities physics teacher at Madison Park Technical Vocational High School, talking about kind of what that means for teachers on the ground.
That is so much work to now have to plan for online learning as well as in-person learning. The idea that these two things, like, oh, just record your lessons, oh, just that is indicative that you are not a teacher. That's not what you really need to do to engage students online.
So I'm actually a former high school teacher myself, and I totally can understand where Joellen is coming from there. You would present a lesson plan totally differently if you're connecting remotely versus if you're in the classroom. So what do you make of the fact that you're asking teachers to basically prepare two lesson plans as they approach the fall?
So I don't think that's exactly what's happening. What we're looking to do right now is to say, we don't have control over the trajectory of the virus. We're not exactly sure if we're going to have a second spike or not in the fall. And so at the end of the day, we have to be ready for all contingencies. Now, what I think the teacher is speaking to, and as a former employee at Madison Park, what I would say is, you know, we have to be smart about how we figure this out. And in-person learning is obviously probably the most desirable possibility. But if you do hybrid learning, what we need to do is minimize the extra effort put on teachers by doing that. Now, you could do that in several ways. You could use teachers that have underlying medical conditions or are over a certain age who may not be able to come back into the classroom and put them on kind of the online portion of that. We are in the process of looking at a learning management platform, which is a computer-based program, which is more student self-directed. And so there's just different opportunities to look at it. Now, the live streaming option is also a possibility, right? If you're teaching a class of 15 kids and there's 15 of your other kids sitting at home watching the lesson online, that's a possibility that some districts have done. There are some complications that come with that. But I think there's different ways to sort out the issues, and we just have to be very thoughtful about how we do it.
I understand the leaving options open to districts is done out of a sense of letting them kind of control what's best for their situation. I am wondering if you have any concerns that some districts either won't follow the guidelines, don't have the resources to follow the guidelines, and therefore are putting their staff and students more at risk than others.
Well, what we're saying right now is we have turned out guidance which has specific medical parameters done by experts in the medical field in Boston, which is, you know, Boston is universally regarded, Massachusetts as, you know, a leading medical place in the world. And we're asking people to kind of feasibility test what in-person learning could look like. And so we're going to get more of that information in the next several weeks to see, you know, can districts do this or not? What does it look like? Some districts might be able to do it without making any changes to their schedules. Some districts might need to just stand up a few extra classrooms to reduce class size. And then there are some districts that might have to do something different because maybe the class sizes are large or what have you. And so what we need to do is have schools and districts do this feasibility testing, given these new medical parameters, and then we'll really have a better sense of what is possible.
I'm glad you mentioned class size, because I think that's something, obviously, some districts had expressed concern over, but also something that some were surprised there wasn't some sort of guidance in terms of class sizes. Why did you guys decide not to include that in the plan?
Well, it's just done differently, right? It's not done by a specific number. It's done by a specific distance. So what we said was we want our districts and schools to aim for 6 feet of distancing, but no less than 3 feet. And so it's that 3-foot number which will determine what class sizes can be, and it'll be based on the size of the classroom. So obviously larger classrooms can hold more students and smaller ones will hold fewer, but that is kind of the individual school and district work that needs to take place so that districts and schools can understand what is feasible or not.
Are you concerned at all about the timeline in doing so? I mean, we're looking, you know, only a few months before September. It's pretty tight to get ready for the school year anyway, and now we have all these additional challenges.
No, I think, you know, the superintendents and principals have really kind of risen to the challenge around this feasibility study And, you know, I think that they're going to be able to turn that around relatively quickly. And with that said, you know, the summer is approaching. I know it seems like the school year has just ended, but the new school year starts quickly. And so there is work to be done. And, you know, we're going to endeavor to do it.
I'm curious in terms of input, how much you've heard from parents as you've been formulating this plan. The Massing Polling Group survey that I mentioned found that almost 70% of parents say they haven't been asked for input on the reopening. Do you wish that there had been more parental involvement, and is there a way that could have been done, or do you feel that you've adequately heard from that population?
So we at the state have heard a lot from parents on a variety of issues. Perhaps the one that's we've heard most often is about complex special needs parents who want their kids back in school because their kids have been regressing significantly by not having the services they get at the school. With that said, we've put in our guidance kind of a requirement that districts and schools reach out multiple times to families over the summer to get a sense of where they're at, and connect with them, make sure they have updated information from families, and really make sure that they are staying in touch with them, because there was some concern that not every district had been staying robustly in touch with their families throughout the outbreak.
Yeah, Commissioner Riley, as we're winding to a close here, I want to ask you, as we've been having lots of conversations over the last few weeks, something that is kind of been present through all of them is our national reckoning with racial inequity. And I'm wondering if you see this as a moment to potentially make major changes or reforms to either curriculum or what schooling looks like. How are you thinking about that in this moment?
So equity has been one, if not the top priority of the department since I took over a couple of years ago. We have a real focus inside of the department on improving the diversity amongst our teachers and principals and superintendents. Right now, we know 40% of our students are students of color, but only 8% of our teachers are. And we need to do better. The research is clear that students who see someone that looks like them are more likely to do better academically in high school and more likely to have better life outcomes. And yet we are behind on really diversifying our workforce. At the same time, we recognize that kids have a lot of questions, right? And there's been, you know, heightened anxiety amongst everyone in the country. And we think that schools are the place where, I mean, I think in Massachusetts, we have the best teachers in the country. And I think that our kids would benefit by having them at the head of the class leading some of these discussions, some of which may involve, by the way, how are we reflecting all voices in our curriculum?
So that disparity that you outlined is pretty staggering. Do you have any specific steps? I mean, I understand everybody's thinking and talking about how to increase diversity, but do you have specific steps that you'd like to see or that you recommend for districts across the state?
So, you know, I did some of this work in my previous role in Lawrence, where we were able to triple the number of Latino teachers in a 5-year period. And we were able to do that because we were able to kind of track our high school graduates who went to college, bring them back, offer them things like signing bonuses, tuition reimbursement. We put them in something called the NACA program, which is this amazing mortgage program where no points, no closing costs. And if your average person is getting a mortgage rate for 4% today, we were getting our young teachers a mortgage rate for like 1% or 2%. And so we were able to kind of rebuild our middle class in Lawrence by bringing our students back. And they were getting mortgages that were significantly cheaper than what they would have had to pay in Lawrence for rent. And so I think there are a suite of services and inducements that we can make to try to improve the diversity of our teacher corps.
That's Jeff Riley, Commissioner Riley.
On a large scale. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I appreciate it. I think something to really chew on there. That's Jeff Riley, Commissioner of Early and Secondary Education. Commissioner Riley, thanks so much for the time today.
Thanks for having me.